This is Precepts Audio Message PA-256. Nathan C. Johnson, Bible Teacher. For all those who love our Lord Jesus Christ in truth.
Book of Ecclesiastes. And last time we considered from chapter 3. And in verse 11, where God set the world olam in men's hearts. And he talks about the fact that men have this idea that the world is not the way it should be. And a longing for a better world, a better situation. Now, a lot of people, because they don't love God and they don't care about God, they would not necessarily appreciate God's world. But still, they have it in their heart that there is a better world than this. And then in verse 14, we have the same thing. Whatever God does, it shall be for the olam, for the eon. And we talked about that doesn't mean that whatever God does, it lasts forever, because there are plenty of things that God does that don't last forever. God changes dispensations, and his works change, and his works don't last forever. But whatever God does, it's for the purpose of the olam. That's God's purpose that he's working toward. That's what he is working to achieve. And that which has been is now, and that which is now has already been, and God requires that which is past. So it seems that there's this useless cycle where everything is repeated over and over, it seems, generation after generation. And yet ultimately God will bring everything that has come to pass into account. And this cycle of death and birth will not continue forever, because someday there will be resurrection. So then he looked, starting in verse 16, under the sun and saw the place of judgment, that wickedness was there, and the place of righteousness, that iniquity was there. So he sees injustice. But he said in his heart that God is going to judge the righteous and the wicked. God will bring things into order. Before him, there's a time for every purpose and every work. So some things might never be made right in this world, but God will make them right. And then he wants the sons of men to see that they are beasts, in the fact that one thing befalls the sons of men and beasts. And that is that as the one dies, so the other dies. They all have the same spirit, the same breath from God. So a man has no preeminence above a beast in this. So all is just emptiness, because they all go to one place. All are of the dust, and all turn to dust again. And once you're dust, doesn't matter if you were an animal or a human. And then he says, who knows the spirit of man, whether it goes upward, or the spirit of the beast, whether it goes downward to the earth? Who knows if there's actually any difference? And I think as far as that goes, the difference is that men will be resurrected. So he says he perceives that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his portion. For who shall bring him to see what shall be after him? So we see that without resurrection, this world indeed has little purpose. There's little point. There's really no advantage, like he says, between men and beasts. Without resurrection, without the kingdom in view, well, what's the difference? Once you're dead, it doesn't matter what you were. And then in chapter 4, he considers all the oppressions that are done under the sun, that are done on the earth. And he sees the tears of the oppressed, and they have no comforter. And their oppressors have power. So in the light of this, he prays the dead, those who have, from death, have escaped from oppression, because they're better off than those who are alive and still being oppressed. He says, better is he than both they which has not been, who has not seen the evil work that is done under the sun. So he considers travail and right work, and he says, even if you do right work, you're envied by your neighbor. But the fool folds his hands together and eats his own flesh. The fool wastes away because he won't work. So he says, it's better to have a handful, to have a little bit with quietness, than both hands full with travail and vexation of spirit. Then he sees another vanity in verse 8, that there is a man who's all alone. He doesn't have a second. He has no partner. He doesn't have a child. He doesn't have a brother, and yet he works. There's no end to all his labor. He's not satisfied with all his riches. And he asks himself, what am I working for? Why am I bereaving my soul of good? Why am I not enjoying life, working so hard. Because, of course, he has nothing to leave his money to, nobody to work for. Then he says, two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, the one will lift up his fellow, but woe to him that is alone when he falls, for he has not another to help him up. Again, if two lie together, then they have heat, but how can one be warm alone? And as I pointed out, that whole be warm could also mean conceive. And the figure of lie together could be talking about conception. Well, you can't have conception unless two lie together. If one prevail against him, two shall withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. So it's good not to be alone. Then he says, better is a poor and wise child than an old and foolish king, who will no more be admonished. And certainly that can happen to kings. They refuse to learn anything. For out of prison he comes to reign. And Bullinger points out that that happened with Joseph and with Daniel. Of course, both Joseph and Daniel became second in command of their nations out of prison, or out of captivity. But he who is born in his kingdom becomes poor. And he points out, Bullinger points out an example of that is Rehoboam, who inherited all Solomon's wealth, and yet it was all robbed by Shishak, king of Egypt. And then he considers all the living which walk under the sun with a second child that shall stand up in his stead. There is no end of all the people, even of all that have been before them. And they also that come after shall not rejoice in him. And we talk about if we think back, you can think back to your parents and your grandparents, but get back very far into your great-grandparents, you probably didn't even know them, don't even remember them. If you know anything about them, they're from a family tree or a name on a page, you don't know them personally. And you go too many generations back and you don't know anything about them. So this is vanity and vexation of spirit. So that's as far as we got last time, and we're up to chapter 5. Chapter 5 and verse 1. Keep thy foot when thou goest to the house of God, and be more ready to hear than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they consider not that they do evil. So he says, keep your foot, or watch your steps. Watch your step when you go to the house of God. Now, of course, Solomon was writing at a time when the temple was built. In fact, it was newly built. Of course, Solomon himself built it, following the plans given to him by David. So the house of God, of course, is the temple of God in Jerusalem. Now, God there is the God, the Elohim in Hebrew, meaning, of course, the true God. Keep your foot when you go to the house of the God, the true God. And be more ready to hear than to give the sacrifice of fools. Now, to hear there has the idea of obey. So be more ready to obey than to give sacrifice. Now, that sounds like a familiar story back in 1 Samuel chapter 15, when Samuel told Saul that obedience is better than sacrifice. And so Solomon's advice here is to be more ready to obey God when you go to his house than be ready to give the sacrifice of fools. Because fools can give a sacrifice. Any fool can give a sacrifice. And the idea of fool there, according to the Companion Bible, the Hebrew word kessel, means fat or inert. The lazy, they want to bring a sacrifice and then not do anything else for God. See, if I bring a sacrifice, that's good enough. I can live however I want otherwise, as long as I bring God a sacrifice. So he says, no, be more ready to obey than to give the sacrifice of the inert, of the lazy, of those who don't want to serve God. He says, for they consider not that they do evil. And evil there is the Hebrew ra'ah, and we think of evil as meaning wickedness. But the Hebrew ra'ah meant more basically calamity. And of course, they're going to bring calamity upon themselves by thinking that they can sacrifice to God and yet not obey him. Well, they don't consider that. They don't realize that. They think that bringing sacrifice, they'll be okay. And they don't have to worry about obeying him. But of course, that is foolish. Then verse 2. Be not rash with thy mouth, and let not thine heart be hasty to utter anything before God. For God is in heaven, and thou upon earth. Therefore let thy words be few. So he warns as you're speaking before God. And we have to realize that the idea of coming to God's temple is that that was God's house. We think of it in our day, we realize that there is no building, there is no place on earth you can go where you're closer to God, where you're nearer to God than any other place. God is the God of the whole earth. God is always present. And going to some building, some special church or temple or any such thing doesn't bring you any nearer to God than any other place. But that's because God has not identified himself with any building. God has not identified himself with any place. But the thing with the temple in Jerusalem was that God had identified himself with that building. God had identified himself with that temple. And of course, only God could do it. Men can build buildings till they're blue in the face and say, this building, I'm building it for God. But God is not going to move in. But the temple he'd identified himself with, so we have to remember that you are coming before God in a special way when you enter God's temple. So he says, when you enter God's temple, be careful. Don't be rash with your mouth. Don't be rash in what you speak. And don't let your heart be hasty to utter anything before God. Now, how does a heart utter something? Well, of course, our heart doesn't utter anything except through our mouths. Although we do believe that we can pray in our thoughts and God can hear us. Of course, that story from 1 Samuel 1 where Hannah was praying to God and her lips were moving but no sound was coming out. Well, God knew what she was saying because he doesn't need to hear her voice. He can hear her heart. But he says, let not your heart be hasty to utter anything before God. Well, this would seem to be a warning against prayer. Don't pray too much or you'll get in trouble. Is that what it means? Well, no, I think God isn't telling us not to pray too much. He wants us to pray. I think he wants to hear from us. But the point, I think, of praying here is of boasting to God of what you're going to do. God, I'm going to do this. God, I'm going to do that. God, I promise this. God, I promise that. If you'll just do this, I'll do that. How many people say that? God, if you will just do this, I will do that and that and that for you. And how often, I wonder, if the thing they're asking for happens, do they forget all about their promises? Well, they are just hasty to utter things before God, either with their mouth or with their heart. And yet, it's just done rashly. It's not done with any real consideration or that they're really going to carry through on it. Now, Hannah, we know her promise to God. She promised if God would give her a son, she would give him back to him, and she did. So she was not rash and hasty. He says, God is in heaven and you upon earth. So he means even when you're going into the house of God, the temple, well, that's God's house, but still, God is in heaven. God is in the exalted place. We realize that's where Jesus Christ, the visible form of God, was at the time. And you are upon earth. Again, that's the same idea as under the sun that we get all through here. So he says, therefore, let your words be few. So he says, when you are before God in the temple, in Hebrew, that's literally in the face of God. Because when you're in the temple, you're in his face. He says, don't be uttering hasty things that you won't intend to actually carry through on. He's in heaven, you're on earth, so you should let your words be few. Let your boast be few. When you tell God you're going to do something, you better mean it. Verse 3, for a dream cometh through the multitude of business. And a fool's voice is known by multitude of words. Now this is a strange thing. A dream comes through the multitude of business. I'm trying to think, when you're really busy with things, are you more likely to dream? Well, if I was going to guess what it meant, I would take the dream to be more on the idea of a daydream or when you have a dream. You know, although Martin Luther King's speech, I have a dream. And of course, his dream was something that he would like to see come to pass. Well, if you'd like to see something come to pass, well, if you do a lot of work to make it come to pass, maybe that's the most likely it's going to happen. And a lot of people have had a dream and made it come true. It's through a lot of work, through a multitude of business. Yet at the same time, as I look at the Hebrew, the Hebrew word for dream there seems to literally mean a night dream. So I don't know why a night dream would come through the multitude of business. So I admit that rather puzzles me. It would make more sense to me, like I said, if it was the other kind of dream. And maybe it is. He says, and a fool's voice is known by multitude of words. So if we take it as being a parallel there, maybe the dream he's talking about is an undesirable thing. A nightmare, a bad dream, comes because you're stressed. And a fool's voice is known because he talks too much. Then verse 4, when thou vowest a vow unto God, defer not to pay it, for he hath no pleasure in fools. Pay that which thou hast vowed. Well, this we see is right along in line with what he was talking about back in verses 1 and 2. So don't be too hasty to utter your boast before God, and when you vow a vow to God, of course that's taking your boast to God to the next level. You're not only telling God you're going to do things, you're actually making a vow to him that you're going to do it. Now he says, when you do vow a vow to God, don't defer to pay it. Don't say, oh God, I'm going to keep my vow, but I'll keep it later. He says, no, take care. When you vow to do something for God, do it. When you make a solemn vow before him, don't defer it. He says, for he has no pleasure in fools. And again, it's kessel, in fat or inert people, in lazy people, or foolish people who make vows to him and then show empty pockets when it comes time for them to pay it. So he says, pay that which thou hast vowed. God is going to have no pleasure in you if you make a vow and then don't fulfill it. So verse 5, he says, better is it that thou shouldst not vow than that thou shouldst vow and not pay. He says, I know you're trying to show your loyalty to God or your service to him or your zeal for him by making this vow. But he says, what good does that do if you don't pay the vow? If you don't carry it out, if you don't carry through on it? He says, it's better that you don't vow at all than that you make a vow and then don't pay it. Now he's assuming that the vow to God is that you're going to give something to God, a sacrifice or money or some kind of offering. But, of course, there are other things, like, we know Paul made a vow that he would be in Jerusalem for a certain feast and so forth. But he says, well, yes, vow shows your zeal for God, but if you make the vow and then don't pay it, then it didn't really show your zeal for God, did it? It would, like, show the opposite. It showed unfaithfulness. So it's better not to vow at all than vow and not pay. Verse 6, suffer not thy mouth to cause thy flesh to sin. Neither say thou before the angel that it was an error. Wherefore should God be angry at thy voice and destroy the work of thine hands? So he says, don't allow your mouth to cause your flesh, your body, to sin. Now, of course, vows didn't just have to do with things that you would pay, like money or sacrifices, but it could also be a vow regarding other things. We know that the Nazarite vow regarded not drinking wine or grape juice or eating grapes or eating raisins or grape stems or anything having to do with grapes. Well, if you made a Nazarite vow and then ate grapes or drank wine or something, well, then your mouth caused your body to sin. Of course, it wasn't a sin to do those things otherwise, but if you vowed not to, or if you vowed that you're not going to get married, we have that in 1 Timothy chapter 5, right? These widow women who are vowing to stay single, to stay widowed, not remarry, and to devote their lives to God. And then a few years down the line, they'd meet Mr. Right number 2 and get married again, and their mouth caused their flesh to sin. There's no sin in a widow getting remarried, but there is if you vowed to God that you weren't going to do it. So that's why Paul told him, Timothy, in 1 Timothy 5, not to let the widows make that vow anymore unless they were over 60 years of age, old enough to probably know what they're talking about, not be young and melodramatic. So don't let your mouth cause your flesh to sin by vowing something that you're not going to carry out. Neither say thou before the angel. Remember that in Hebrew, just like in Greek, the word angel can also mean a messenger. Our book of Malachi in the Bible, Malachi is the word for an angel. That's the Hebrew word. Of course, angel is the Greek word angelos. That's where we get angel from, is a Greek word. But Malachi is the Hebrew word for an angel. And of course, the book of Malachi was not written by a heavenly angel. It's written by a human messenger. So I don't think this is necessarily a heavenly angel. I think this is a messenger that is coming to collect your vow from you. And so he comes to collect your vow, and you say, oh, no, it was a mistake. It was an error. I shouldn't have made that vow. I shouldn't have made that vow, he says to the Malach, to the angel. So he says, wherefore should God be angry at your voice and destroy the work of your hand? So if God hears that kind of thing, if God would be angry at what you said, and he would destroy the work of your hands, or the Bullinger suggests the word means confiscate. He says, if you refuse to pay your vow to God, God just might confiscate it from you and be angry at you besides. So, of course, his warning is, be careful what you vow to God. Verse 7, for in the multitude of dreams and many words there are also diverse vanities. But fear thou God. So he says, in a multitude of dreams and in a multitude of words, there is also great vanity. There is also great emptiness. Just again, that's the word vapor or breath. The common theme of Ecclesiastes is that this life is like a vapor, a breath, emptiness. So there's emptiness in many dreams, there's emptiness in many words. He says, but fear thou God. God is what you should respect. God is what you should reverence. Reverence him and don't pay too much attention to dreams. And don't be given to too many words. Of course, especially when it comes to making foolish vows or foolish boasts before God. Verse 8. If thou seest the oppression of the poor, and violent perverting of judgment and justice in a province, marvel not at the matter. For he that is higher than the highest regardeth, and there be higher than they. So he says, if you see the oppression of the poor, and the poor there is the needy, those who are in want, those who do not have enough. If you see them being oppressed, and you see the violent perverting of judgment and righteousness in a province. And it says judgment and justice. We have to remember that just and righteous go together. That to be righteous is to be right, to be just, to be fair. And so you see the perverting of judgment and righteousness in a province. Well, he says, don't marvel at the matter. Don't marvel at that. Why? For he that is higher than the highest regardeth. So God sees it. And there be higher than they. Bullinger makes that the high one, with a capital O, above the high one regardeth. Even the most high is over them. So he says, don't be too upset when you see oppression and injustice and perverting of justice and righteousness. Don't marvel at it. Don't be too upset at it, because the high one above all these high ones, he sees it. And he is over them. So he says, you'll know that someday these who have oppress the poor and have perverted justice, someday they will be called to account for it. So don't think they get away with it. Don't think that nothing is being done about it. The high one who is over them sees it. Of course, in Israel, God might certainly bring punishment upon the wicked, and often did. In our day, the dispensation of grace, God does not bring punishment. Often wickedness brings disaster. That's why the evil word ra'ah, calamity, is often used for wicked deeds that bring calamity. But the fact is, in the dispensation of grace, there's no law that the oppressors and the those who pervert justice will receive their reward in this life, but certainly they will in the life to come. In verse 9 he says, "Moreover, the profit of the earth is for all. The king himself is served by the field." Remember, of course, that the word earth in Hebrew, eretz, you could translate it the ground or the land, as well as the earth. And I think here it's definitely talking about the profit of the land, the crops. Well, that is for all. And the king himself is served by the field. So the profit of the earth is the whole of it. And even the king, he depends on it. And, of course, as we see the famine in Israel in the days of Elijah, well, even King Ahab has to depend on the field, and he's out trying to find grass to feed his animals, because the king, too, depends on the profit of the land. Verse 10, "He that loveth silver shall not be satisfied with silver, nor he that loveth abundance with increase. This is also vanity." So one who loves silver, I think there is put for all kinds of money, he's not satisfied with what he has. And who, he says, is ever content with abundance without interest? If he has money, he wants to be getting some kind of interest, some kind of increase on the money he has. He wants to put it to work and get more. So he says, this also is emptiness. Because what you have, you're never content with it. You always want more. And he says, verse 11, "When goods increase, they are increased that eat them. And what good is there to the owners thereof, saving the beholding of them with their eyes?" So when your goods increase, when what you have increases, well, then you just increase those who eat them. Of course, as companies grow, it just means they have more employees to pay. If your household grows, you just have more household servants, more people working for you. So, yes, you're increasing your wealth, but then you just have all that many more expenses. And he says, "What good is there to the owners thereof? What advantage do they have in gaining more and more wealth? Save the beholding look." And he were the beholding look with their eyes. They're looking over all their riches and enjoying the sight of them. But what other good is there to them of their goods increasing? Whereas he says, verse 12, "The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eat little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not suffer him to sleep." Of course, the idea there is to sleep soundly. The poor, the laboring man, the man who's living hand to mouth, his sleep is sweet. Might not have a very, very big dinner, might not have a whole lot of food, but he's got no worries. He doesn't have any things, he doesn't worry about being stolen. But the abundance of the rich, he can't sleep soundly because he's always worried about somehow losing it. "There is a sore evil which I have seen under the sun, namely riches kept for the owners thereof to their hurt." So here he has another sore evil, a sore calamity, which he has seen under the sun, a sore calamity which he has seen on the earth. And what is this sore calamity? "Riches kept for the owners thereof to their hurt." And hurt there is again ra'ah, their calamity. So they hoarded these riches, and the riches only harmed them. They didn't bring them any good. They just brought them harm. Well, that happens sometimes. Sometimes wealth brings harm. We see that, of course, we see people win the lottery and how often their lives are destroyed by that sudden influx of money that they don't know how to handle, haven't earned, don't know how to handle. But sometimes owners hold on to riches, refuse to distribute them in any way, and it just hurts them. "But those riches perish by evil travail, and he begetteth a son, and there is nothing in his hand." So those riches perish. Those riches come to an end. By evil travail is, evil is again the Hebrew ra'ah. And I'd make this by calamitous fatigue. Those riches are worn out by calamity. I don't know if it's hard to imagine riches having fatigue. But basically, calamity wears them out. And they come to an end. And so then, this one who kept his riches, held on to them, grasped on to them, refused to let them go. They all wear away. And then when he begets a son, there's nothing in his hand. There's nothing to give his son, nothing to pass on to the next generation. So here he held on to his riches, was stingy, wouldn't let them go. And yet next thing he knows, they're gone by calamity and by fatigue, and he has nothing to pass on. Well, that, he says, is a sore calamity when that happens. In verse 15, as he came forth of his mother's womb, naked shall he return to go as he came, and shall take nothing of his labor which he may carry away in his hand. And this is a reality that people have often liked to deny. We know in ancient Egypt they tried to deny this idea that you couldn't take anything when the rich would die, when the pharaohs would die. Sometimes they would kill a bunch of their servants and put them in their tomb so they could serve him in the afterlife, and they'd put his favorite furniture there, and his, even if he had a game he liked to play, they'd put all these things there, put food there, supposedly because he needs those things in his next life. Well, he doesn't need those things. Once he dies, what good is putting dead servants in his tomb, or furniture, or games, or food, or anything? No, when you come out of your mother's womb, you're naked. You come out with nothing. And when you die, you go back like you came. You go back with nothing. Does that bit of soil that used to be your body, does that really own the things you gather around it? It's just soil. Once you're dead, once the spirit has left, there's nothing left but the soil, and it quickly returns to the soil. So if you put a lot of goods around that soil, what good does that do? So you go back to where you came from, you return just as you came, naked. And all your work, all your hard work, you don't take that away with you. You can't carry it away in your hand. You put something in the corpse's hand, but he still can't carry it away with him. Now here we see the reality of what the Bible, throughout the Bible, says death is, that death is a return. And we realize that the teaching of many today is to deny this. They say that death is a separation. It's the separation of some immortal soul that goes right on living and is still conscious and aware. It's just separated from the body, and they call death a separation. But the Bible never calls death a separation. The Bible calls death a return. And that's what we see here. This one who dies, he returns like he came. He came naked, he returns naked when he dies. So the Bible's teaching is that death is a return, not a separation. Verse 16, and this also is a sore evil, that in all points as he came, so shall he go. And what profit hath he that hath labored for the wind? So he says, this also is a sore calamity. This also is a calamity that's hard to bear. But that in all points as he came, so shall he go. See, what advantage does the little baby have when he's born? Nothing. He's just a little naked baby. He's got no skills, no talents, no knowledge, no wisdom. He doesn't own anything. And how does he go when he dies? He goes the same way. He's got nothing when he dies. Once again, he has no skills, no talents, no abilities, no knowledge. He doesn't own anything. Once he's dead, he's the same way as when he was born. He's got nothing. And what profit has he that hath labored for the wind? So he's done all this work, all this labor, and he's lying there dead. What good did all that do him? Now that he's dead, how does it benefit him at this point? Well, it doesn't benefit him at all. All the good work he did, if it was good work, it was hard work, if it benefited him at the time, what does it benefit him now? He's dead. He says he just labored for the wind, and all his work just goes to the wind. The wind there is ruach, which is often translated spirit. but it's also used for the wind. So he just labored for the wind. And again, this is a sad picture, depressing picture, but it's the real picture when you leave the kingdom out of it. What good is anything that you did at all if you just focus on this life? What good does it do you once you're dead? None. So only when we bring the kingdom into the equation does anything in our life have any meaning or any purpose. Otherwise, at death, didn't do any good. Everything you did was just for the wind. It's all gone. Verse 17, all his days also he eateth in darkness, and he hath much sorrow and wrath with his sickness. So now, he says, all his days also he eats in darkness, and has sorrow and wrath with the sickness. So, what this is referring to, and perhaps in the context, is as he's nearing death, or it could be going back to those that are oppressed, or those who do not benefit from the riches that they gather. But anyway, this picture, he eats in darkness, and he has sorrow and wrath and sickness. So, what good does it do him? Does working hard bring light? Only God can bring light into your life. Does working hard take away sorrow? No. Does it take away wrath? Does it take away things that happen to you that make you angry? No. Does it take away sickness? No. So you work hard, it doesn't keep you from becoming sick, or doesn't bring light into your life, doesn't keep sorrow out. Verse 18, behold that which I have seen. It is good and comely for one to eat and to drink, and to enjoy the good of all his labor that he taketh under the sun all the days of his life, which God giveth him, for it is his portion. So he says that he has seen that this is good. What is it that he saw? What does he conclude? Well, it's good, and it's comely, it's well, it's a good thing for one to eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. If you can eat and drink and enjoy the benefits of your work in food and drink, and of course food and drink are the most basic and the most important things that you're working for. Without those, what good is all the other things do you if you can't eat and drink? He says, if one eats and drinks and enjoys the good of all his labor that he takes under the sun all the days of his life, well, that's a good thing. Which God giveth him. All the days that God gives him, he's able to eat and drink and enjoy the fruits of his labor. Well, that's his portion. That's a good thing if he can do that. Verse 19, every man also to whom God hath given riches and wealth and hath given him power to eat thereof, and to take his portion, and to rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. So every man, and the word there in Hebrew is Adam, every one of Adam's race to whom God has given riches and wealth, and given him power to eat of it, given him power to enjoy it. Because we saw earlier, the one who had wealth, and yet didn't have the power to enjoy it. He was so stingy. He was laying up all this wealth. He had no family. He had no partner, he had nobody to be working for, to be leaving all this wealth to. And yet his own attitude, his own stinginess, his own desire for wealth kept him from enjoying the good of what wealth he'd gathered. He was depriving himself of good, storing up all this wealth for no purpose. He says, if God gives you riches and wealth and gives you the power to enjoy it and to take your portion from it and to rejoice in your hard work that got it to you, well, he says, this is the gift of God. That's a gift from God if you can do that. Verse 20, for he shall not much remember the days of his life, because God answereth him in the joy of his heart. So he doesn't often sit down and worry and think, what good is this empty life I'm living? It's going to come to an end. I'll soon die. No, he doesn't much think about that. That doesn't much bother him. Because God says answers. Bolger says causes to respond, or God busies him in the joy of his heart. So he enjoys his work, and he enjoys what he gets from his work. So God keeps him busy in all those things. And so he has not too much time to reflect on the emptiness of his life, because he's busy with things he enjoys. So he says that's a gift from God when you can live that way. And it's true, although at the same time, I think it's good for us to reflect sometimes on our life, because we do need to realize the importance of the kingdom. But again, Solomon is focusing just on this life and saying, what's good in it? And there's not much, but here's one thing that could be good, is if you have plenty and you're able to enjoy it. Well, that's good. Plenty of people have plenty. A lot of people don't have plenty, they don't have enough. A lot of people who do have plenty can't eat and enjoy it. It's the one who has plenty and can enjoy it, that's a gift from God. Chapter 6 and verse 1. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it is common among men. So now he speaks of another evil, another calamity, which he has seen under the sun, which he has seen on earth. He says this one is a common calamity among Adam. Again, it's the Hebrew word Adam. Adam's race, humanity. This is a common calamity. What? Verse 2, a man to whom God hath given riches, wealth, and honor, so that he wanteth nothing for his soul of all that he desireth. Yet God giveth him not power to eat thereof, but a stranger eateth it. This is vanity, and it is an evil disease. So here is the opposite of what we saw at the end of chapter 5. Here is a man to whom God has given riches, wealth, and honor. So he has riches, he has wealth, he has plenty of goods, and he has honor. He is honored, he is respected. So he lacks nothing for his soul of all that he desires. Remember that the word soul, the Hebrew word nephesh, is used of the emotions and the desires. And so we see there his soul desires certain things, and he lacks nothing of all those things that he would desire, that his soul desires, that his soul needs to live a comfortable life. Yet God gives him not power to eat thereof. He's not able to enjoy it. He's either so fixated on getting more wealth, or he is so worried about other things, or there's so many family calamities he's worried about, or whatever, that he just doesn't have power to eat of all this good that he has. And to eat there means not just that he isn't able to eat food, but he's not able to enjoy the good that he has, whether it's eating or just enjoying all his wealth. He's not able to enjoy it. But ultimately, a stranger eats and enjoys it, not his own family, not himself, but someone else gets all his wealth, and he ultimately enjoys it. And this rich man who gathered all the wealth never gets to enjoy it. Well, he says, this is vanity. This is, again, a vapor, a breath. This is emptiness. It is an evil disease, a calamitous disease, when someone makes money and never gets to enjoy it. And some stranger, some alien man does. Verse 3, if a man beget 100 children, and live many years, so that the days of his years be many, and his soul be not filled with good, and also that he have no burial, I say that an untimely birth is better than he. So first he lists two things that they would have considered very desirable. He begets 100 children. Well, children were thought to be a great honor, a wonderful thing if he had many children. So this man has 100 of them. So he has certainly more than you need of children. And he has long life. He lives many years. The days of his years are many. That's another very desirable thing, to have a long life. And yet his soul is not filled with good. What he desires, his desires are never satisfied. His soul is never satisfied with good. And also he has no burial. And this was another thing that was very important for them. It was thought that if you didn't receive a decent burial, if you weren't honored in death, well, that just cast dishonor over your whole life if you were not cared for at death. So his soul isn't filled with good while he lives, and when he dies, he has no decent burial. So he says, I say that an untimely birth, a miscarriage, is better than he. Why is a miscarriage better than he? Verse 4, for he cometh in with vanity and departeth in darkness, and his name shall be covered with darkness. So he says, he, that is the untimely birth, he comes in with emptiness and departs in darkness. So he never really lives. He comes in with emptiness at the wrong time, too soon. And he dies and departs in darkness, and his name is covered with darkness. He's never known who he would have been or what he would have been if he had lived. He died, and his name is covered in darkness. His parents never name him. He never gets any reputation. Nobody gets to know what he would have been like. Verse 5, moreover, he hath not seen the sun nor known anything. This hath more rest than the other. So he never really saw the sun. He never really got to know anything. But at least he gets rest. He gets to rest. Well, the other, the man who lived a long life and he had all these children, and yet his desire was never satisfied in life, and he was never honored in death, well, he had a long life full of unrest. And he says, the stillborn, the miscarriage, the early birth, the untimely birth, who dies, well, he gets more rest than the one who lived for all those years and was never happy, never satisfied. Verse 6, yea, though he live 1,000 years, twice told, yet hath he seen no good. Do not all go to one place? So he says, even if this man with a long life, if he lives 1,000 years, he has 1,000 years twice, 2,000 years. Yet has he seen no good? What good has he really seen? What good does it really do him if his desire isn't satisfied? And then he says, do not all go to one place. And of course, the one place is Sheol. And what does it matter if you're Adam or those soon after creation who lived 1,000 years? Or if you're someone more recent time who didn't even live 100? If you're in Sheol, you're in Sheol. They all went to one place. Doesn't matter how long you lived. Once you die, you're dead. Can't say, well, he lived a good long life. Well, but now he's dead. If he lived a short, unusually short life and was dead, or if he lived a long life and is dead, either way, he's dead. They're both in Sheol. And the one who dies from the untimely birth, he's in Sheol just like the one who lived the long life. And the one who lived a long life and didn't see good, what good did his long life do him? Well, again, this is a very depressing way of looking at things. And yet, we have to acknowledge that it's true. Ultimately, it's true. It's a truth that we don't like to think about or look at very much, but it's true. And again, what can we say? What can we answer this? Well, the answer has to be the life to come. The answer has to be the kingdom. If we try to find our satisfaction in this life, there really is nothing in it. Our hope for the future is to get older. Our bodies break down more and more. Can't do less and less. And finally we die. That's what we have to look forward to. And where's the satisfaction in that? Where's the anticipation? Where's the purpose in living? No, our purpose has to be in the life to come. Otherwise, Sheol is all we have to look forward to, the state of death. So that is the sad yet realistic picture of Ecclesiastes. And we see from this book the emptiness of trying to live for this life only. We realize that ultimate purpose has to come from our relationship with God and from our hope in the life to come. So that's really, I think, the message of Ecclesiastes. We'll continue in chapter 6. We'll start from verse 7 there in our next study, but for now we're out of time, so we'll stop there after verse 6.